as she's going around, she's photographing close up. She's looking into their faces, and it's as though she's searching for her missing friends, seeing if they're somewhere among all those dead people.
Hallo und willkommen. Das ist der Kunstpodcast mit Geschichten und Themen aus der Hamburger Kunstwelt. Hamburg Arts, der Kunstpodcast. Und ich bin Kai Detlefs, Journalist aus Hamburg. Heute die zweite Episode zur Fotografin und Künstlerin Lee Miller. In den 20er Jahren war die junge Amerikanerin ungewöhnlich erfolgreich. Als Fotografin, Künstlerin und Model in Paris und in New York. Dann beginnt ein dunkles Kapitel, die Kriegsjahre. Die Mode- und Porträtfotografin Lee Miller beginnt als Journalistin zu arbeiten und als Kriegsreporterin. Sie dokumentiert die Angriffe der Deutschen auf London, wo sie zu der Zeit mit dem Künstler Ronald Penrose lebt, ihrem späteren Ehemann. Dann geht sie nach Deutschland, legendär das Foto von ihr in der Badewanne von Adolf Hitler. Darüber werden wir reden und wir reden über das Grauen in den Konzentrationslagern. Lee Miller war eine der ersten, die dort Fotos von den Gräueltaten der Deutschen gemacht hat. Das hatte psychische Folgen. Wir nennen es heute eine posttraumatische Belastungsstörung, sagt ihre Enkelin Amy Buhasange. Bei Lee Miller waren es Depressionen und dann der Alkohol, zu viel Alkohol. In dieser Episode teilt Anthony Penrose, der Sohn von Lee Miller, seine sehr persönlichen Gedanken über seine Mutter und über das schwierige Verhältnis zu ihr. Wir beginnen die Episode und das Gespräch im Jahr 1939. We are talking about the year 1939, beginning of World War II, and Lee Miller moved to London to live there. Anthony, why London?
Lee Miller came to London because that was where the man that she loved lived. She had been married to a very wonderful man called Aziz Eloui Bey, and her home had been in Cairo. But in 1937, she had met Roland Penrose while she was in Paris. She spent most of that summer with him in Europe, and that was when they really fell in love. They travelled together the following year, 1938. They went round Romania and the Balkans together. But then in 1939, Roland Penrose went to Cairo to greet Lee and try and persuade her to leave Aziz and come and live with him. And he was successful. He took with him a poem that he had written about their journey together the previous year. He called it "The Road is Wider Than Long." And he gave her the very first printed publication. It's a little photo book. It's a poem. It's really utterly charming. And he also gave her a gift of a pair of golden handcuffs. And she said she found both gifts utterly captivating. And she decided in that moment to leave Aziz. And she arrived in London. And they travelled a little bit in Europe together to see their friends, to see Man Ray and Adi Fidelin, and to see Max Ernst and Leonora Carrington, because they knew the war was coming and they knew things were going to get really bad very quickly. And they were right, because they arrived back in England on the 3rd of September, the day Britain declared war on Germany.
And Lee Miller became a reporter, right? How did she manage to do that?
To begin with, it was very difficult because as an American, she couldn't get a work permit in England and so on. So she had to go through a lot of procedures. But finally, more by networking than anything else, she managed to get a job freelancing for Vogue magazine. And she made a very close friend of Audrey Withers, Vogue's editor at that time. And the combination of those two women was to prove extraordinarily valuable to Vogue and to many other people, because Audrey supported Lee and gave her the platform that she needed to do the photography that she wanted and that she could do. So to begin with, she was photographing fashion. And then, because she wanted to contribute to the war effort in a more direct way, she started to report on the women at war, the women soldiers, the ATS, the women in the Navy, the Wrens, and many others, people like factory workers and nurses and people doing extraordinary things for the war effort at that time. And that led to a series of articles in Vogue. But at that moment, she wasn't writing her own text. That all changed very swiftly about the time of the Normandy landings. And her first really big, significant feature article in Vogue was when she visited the American Casualty Evacuation Hospital at Breckville, just behind Omaha Beach. And she reported back from there. And it is the most astonishingly thorough and revealing article. We really feel that we're right there with them when we read it.
And from her photographs, you can see that even though she's photographing surgeons in doing operations in the tent, you can tell she knows her way around an operating theatre. So you have her old training from when back in Paris when she was working with the surgeon photographing his operations kick in. And when you read her full unedited manuscripts that she submitted to Vogue, you can see she's has this in-depth knowledge of surgical procedures and of the kind of drugs and things that they're using.
We're talking about the glamour, surrealism, fashion, being a supermodel, and now a war photographer. Mm. How does all this fit together?
In a surreal way.
Yeah, I was going to say exactly that it fits together because it belonged to a person who was a surrealist, who was capable of reconciling totally, totally disparate elements in her life. And she did that all along.
People wonder, how does all this fit together? It's amazing, right?
It fits together because of her surrealism, but it also fits together because she was a person with overwhelming curiosity. She always wanted to know how things were done and why they were done and who was doing them and what was going on and could it be done better and was it being effective? And she was kind of naturally, totally inquisitive about everything. And I think that is what gives her journalism such a bite, because she's asking the questions that we would all like to know if we were bright enough to ask them.
And I think one of the other reasons why particularly her writing is very accessible is because she wasn't the model student at school. She was expelled from school more than four times, but she loved reading. She loved literature. We have book lists that her mum wrote from when she was a young child right up until her teenage years of different books that she read, which is quite advanced texts. And in her letters that she writes when she's living in Egypt, she talks about other texts that she was very well read, but nobody tried to train her to write. So she's not trying to emulate some, you know, stuffy person's style. She just writes it how she sees it. And it's almost like you're sitting on her shoulder when you're reading her reports. And it's like she wants to take you for the journey as well.
We also realise when we're reading her writing what a brilliant conversationalist she was, and also those around her. And it's a different age. Now, in a group, so many people watch television or they listen to the radio or something like that. There's a ready-made, pre-packaged entertainment. So they don't perhaps talk in the same way as they used to. And they don't have the same values in conversation of wit and imagination and fast-moving changes of things. So I think that's what really helped her, was the social background that she came from.
But when you look at her photography, even some of the quite disturbing photographs, there is the dead SS guard in the water.
The what, please?
The dead SS guard. He's dead in the canal outside the prison camp. There is, in a very eerie way, there is a real beauty in that photograph. It comes, in a sense, from an artistic background that she comes from. And you often see that in her war photographs. It's not just about fighting and guns and tanks. There is a style that she gives to the images. an aesthetic quality in an unexpected way.
We have to talk about one famous and iconic picture. This is Lee Miller in Adolf Hitler's bathroom. Mm-hmm. I mean, how about this picture? I mean, many people know this. This is an iconic picture. How did this work out?
The evening of the day that Lee and David Sherman had witnessed the liberation of Dachau, they arrived in Munich. And because they had a tip-off from the signalers, they knew where to go to find Hitler's house. And when they arrived, they found the signalers had already taken it over. And they were astonished to find the place had hot water, because it was probably about the only house in Munich that had coal. And so the first thing that they thought of was to get in the tub. And I said to Sherman afterwards, when I was interviewing him, I said, didn't you feel a bit creepy getting into Hitler's bath? And he said, my boy, we hadn't had our clothes off in 3 weeks. We stank like a bunch of polecats. And here was hot water, here was soap, here were towels, and it was just more than we could do to resist it. So Lee hopped in first, and then they realized they had a scope. So they set the shot up. They put the picture of Hitler by Heinrich Hoffmann on the edge of the bath. Hoffmann was Hitler's kind of official photographer. And the extraordinarily ironic thing about that picture is that it was the basis for a poster that was all over Germany in different forms. And it says, Ein Volk, Ein Reich, Ein Führer, Großer Deutschland. And that is exactly what they had been fighting against for the last 4.5 years, 5 years. And that was why they put the picture there, to say, we won. You're toast. Then on the side, on the bath table, there is a little sculpture by Casbeck, Rudolf Casbeck, of a very formalized nude. And this was the kind of taste in sculpture that Hitler really loved. It was a sort of, you know, the health and efficiency type routine. It was the, you know, the strong Aryan nude. And again, don't forget, Hitler had the Degenerate Art Exhibition in Munich in 1937, and that contained work by one of Lee's closest friends, Max Ernst. And so what Lee is saying in that moment is, okay, Hitler, if this is your taste in art, it sucks. But the key to that photograph is the boots on the mat, because the morning of that day, those boots had carried Lee around Dachau, and now she's grinding the filth and the degradation and the horror of that place into Hitler's nice, clean bath mat. She's not sitting there as his guest. She's a victor. She's grinding her heel into his face. And of course, at that moment, 4:45 that afternoon, way across Germany and Berlin, Hitler and Eva Braun had killed themselves.
We are now coming to this extreme experience. Lee Miller was encountering the German concentration camps just when the war was over. So what do you know about the pictures and about this extreme experience Lee Miller had to face?
When Lee arrived in Paris, the war got very personal because so many of her friends were missing. If you just happened to be a dissident, a surrealist artist, or a poet or somebody like that, you were gone. If you happened to be Jewish, it was very much easier to go because they were rounding up a great many Jews, 7,000, I believe, in all, and shipping them off. And nobody knew what was happening. The thought was that they were being taken to work camps and one day they would be repatriated. But that suspicion grew very, very hard to... That theory grew very hard to support because nobody ever came back and nobody ever knew what had happened to these people. And so when Lee got into Germany and encountered the first concentration camps that she'd seen, the first was Ohrdruf and then Penning and then Buchenwald and then Dachau, she realized without any doubt that this is where her missing friends were and that none of them were ever going to come home. And so as she's going around, she's photographing close up. She's looking into their faces, and it's as though she's searching for her missing friends, seeing if they're somewhere among all those dead people.
And this, as we know, was an extreme experience for her, right? This was...
It was what you would call a life-changing experience. I don't think she or Sherman or anybody else who shared that experience were ever the same again. They couldn't be. It's something she carried with her at a very deep level. And we didn't understand that because none of us really knew what she'd done. And it was only when we began to find her photographs and catalogue them and reprint them that we realized just how incredibly penetrating that piece of reporting was and how much it must have cost her emotionally to do it. And then we began to realize the toll that took on her in terms of what we now understand as post-traumatic stress disorder. And it is really important to remember that that's what happens to people who do that kind of reporting. And Lee's life, and our lives too, were very much changed as a result because of that experience.
What can you tell about Lee Miller? How did she behave? Could you feel that she was depressed, whatever happened in your family?
I only knew the outward signs. I knew that she was depressed. But of course, as a child, it's hard to articulate that or understand it at all. I also knew that she was way too dependent on alcohol. But as a child, again, life is what life brings. I just thought that was what people did. And yes, it was difficult and it was uncomfortable. She was never, ever violent when she was drunk. She didn't need to be because she could do all the damage she wanted with words, and she was very good with words. So she and I had a very, very conflicted relationship, which I didn't really resolve until only a couple of years before she died. But I never understood why. Why it had worked out like that until I saw her work, particularly the Holocaust images, and realized how much of a trauma she must have been suppressing for all of those years, because she never, ever spoke about it coherently to anybody, ever. She never told us. She never really talked to my father about it. He was astonished, as I was, when we kept on unearthing these pictures and other images besides. And he just couldn't understand, why did we not know? Why didn't she tell us, was the question that he and I kept on repeating to ourselves.
Which is amazing in a sense, since she was, you know, in the communication business. She was, you know, telling stories. It was her job or her passion to convey stories.
She never told the stories of her inner life. That was the thing. And she, as a small child, at the age of 7, she had been raped and in that moment infected with gonorrhea. And her parents just realized that they had to keep this a secret because it would have impacted on her too much. Because in those days, particularly, the victim was often blamed, and she would have been considered to be, you know, a loose woman or a spent woman or something like that. And so she would have probably never married or never had a career. And they wanted to protect her from that. So they kept that secret underground. They kept it tight. Nobody knew, not even my father, not even my mother's closest friends. And so that's how closely she held things. And so it was not difficult for her to realize that she needed to hold her war experiences as closely as that as well.
Do you think that she ever, you know, could cope with it? Did she overcome this trauma?
I think she learned to cope with it. If you think about after the end of the war, the whole of Europe and the wider area had suffered a huge trauma. Everybody's life had been touched in some way. And the accepted way to deal with those kind of traumas was to put up, to shut up, And if you couldn't deal with it, have a whiskey. And if you still couldn't deal with it, have another one. But, and, you know, things like post-traumatic stress disorder didn't have a name. It was called shell shock. Nobody knew about those kind of mental illnesses. Depression wasn't really understood, even in that time. So she is kind of trying in the dark, trying to find a way to cope with her mental health problems. And eventually she realizes that the drinking's not helping that much. She realizes that something to do with being a photojournalist is not working for her anymore. And that's when she buried her photography in the attic, stopped talking about everything, maybe to protect herself just as much as everybody else. But she's still this incredibly creative and imaginative woman. So she repurposes her energy into a different career and launches herself as a surrealist gourmet cook and becomes written up in Vogue again and other magazines, House and Garden this time as well, as this hostess with the mostess, this kind of cook that makes things like cauliflower breasts and blue spaghetti. And in that way, she is still creative. She still has a career, but she's also learnt to bypass things that, like nowadays, when you talk with war correspondents that still, you know, work, people that know more about PTSD, they know about things like triggers. Those days they didn't. And so she just had to, in her own way, feel her way around it, realise that something was triggering her in what she was doing. So she just changed tacks and went a different way in order to, because you can't get over it. It's not something that suddenly you find the magic golden pill and it stops. You just have to learn to live with it. And she works out this way to live with it and still be creative and still have a career. And that was in cooking. And in fact, there's a couple of articles where she's even quoted as saying, cooking is therapy.
Now, she did this for many, many years, right? This career as a chef de cuisine, as a gourmet chef, she did this for 15 or 20 years, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for her 50th birthday, she sent herself to Paris Cordon Bleu cooking school for 3 months. And came back saying that she didn't like Cordon Bleu, but she was going to go and be a gourmet cook. And when you think about it, food, there's some brilliant parallels between cooking and photography. I don't know if it's the same in German, but in English, that you can overcook your photographs when you're developing them. So, you know, you, as well as burning your food, you can burn your photographs in the chemicals by over developing them. But then also you've got to think about that particular time. Rationing in England, there were still food shortages right into the 50s. So and so there is an importance around food and sharing that food with friends that have survived and are still there despite it all is quite an important thing. And then add to that these people, these piles of starved dead bodies that you've seen in the concentration camps that didn't have food. And then she has food and she can turn it into something beautiful and share it with people that she loved. Then you can see that that's probably part of the healing process as well.
How about the life in this very great building, this house? She had guests, right?
Yeah.
And she was doing all kinds of, yes, fantastic things, cooking for Man Ray, for example.
Yeah, I mean, in fact, her last photojournalistic article that she wrote in 1953 sets her, in a way, is a precursor that sets you up to know that's what's coming next. And it's called Working Guests. And in it, she gets all her friends, who are a lot of the artists that visited, to do all the work. And it's a kind of a jokey piece. So she has Max Ernst digging the flower beds, and another photographer, the British artist Richard Hamilton, sewing the curtains, and people doing her upholstery and things like that. Henry Moore's in there as well. And the whole idea about how... And then the last picture in the article is her pretending to be asleep on the sofa, and it's like everyone else is doing all the work and she's taking it easy. So it's this idea of her as this hostess. It kind of teases you into maybe what she's already thinking about at the time.
How did she get to know all these famous people? If Pablo Picasso, Hamilton, whoever. I mean, how did she get acquainted with all these people?
Most of the big name artists she met when she was a youngster in Paris with Man Ray, and although she may not have made very close connections with them at that time, she knew who they were, and they knew who she was, and so. When she re-met them later, 1937, it was just straightforward. And at that point, they weren't at the moment of their careers when they were unapproachably famous. They were just a bunch of fellow artists who were hanging out on a beach in the south of France. And it kind of like stayed like that. The informality of the friendship stayed right to the end of their lives.
I'd like to talk about your work for a while. How would you describe your work?
Never ending.
You're taking care of the material of Lee Miller, right?
Well, it's not just me alone at this moment. There's a great many other people headed up by Amy, my daughter. But to begin with, yes, it was just my late wife and me. And at that moment, in real life, I was a dairy farmer. And my wife was a ballet teacher. And like overnight, we suddenly had to become photographic archivists and curators. So we had an enormous amount of learning to do. But luckily, my father's connections in the art world allowed us to learn from some of the very, very key people in the photographic sector. And we had to learn from nothing. How to conserve negatives, how to store things properly, how to catalogue things, how to make some sense out of this body of 60,000 negatives and countless pages of manuscripts and vintage prints and all of that kind of stuff. And I just regard myself as being incredibly fortunate because I didn't ask for this, I didn't plan for it. But it has given me the most incredible satisfaction. I've been all over the world. You know, I've been lecturing and working on exhibitions in so many different countries. It leads me to meet people that I would never otherwise meet, to go places, to go backstage in some of the world's finest museums and things like that. I can't believe my luck. And then, things began to develop and we had more people become involved. And then about 25 years ago, Amy joined the archive and she's proved to be the most amazingly good administrator and curator and writer in her own right. And I'm really thrilled because, you know, that gives me some hope that the thing will continue with its present trajectory for a bit longer.
At the beginning, some of the advice that Mum and Dad got from some of the curators that they spoke to through Roland, my granddad, was that they could give, you know, you could give the whole of the collection to a museum. But at that moment, Lee Miller was forgotten. Nobody knew who she was. So her work would have probably gone into the vaults of the Tates or the V&A and been stashed away there until some PhD student came and looked at it and maybe wrote something about it. But the fact that Mum and Dad and Roland decided to work on it and champion her work and put it together and try and make the world, remind the world of who Lee was and what she did and make sure her legacy has not been forgotten is just because the dairy farmer and the ballet teacher thought that they fell in love with the work and thought that it should have the time and attention, and it changed all of our lives.
Thank you. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Ich bedanke mich bei Amy Bourassange und Anthony Penrose für ihre Offenheit und für die vielen Geschichten und Details aus dem Leben von Lee Miller. Danke auch an das Bucerius Kunstforum, das dieses Gespräch in ihren Räumen ermöglicht hat. Die Ausstellung Lee Miller, Fotografin zwischen Krieg und Glamour, ist bis Ende September zu sehen, hier in Hamburg im Bucerius Kunstforum.